Well, today we're thinking about our work days and thinking about work, and perhaps there's three main approaches towards work in the modern day. For some, work is something to avoid wherever possible, dodging responsibility, dragging their feet, just sort of waiting for someone else to pick up their slack. But whilst for others, work is everything. It's their identity, their worth, their success. They literally idolize their career. They're willing to sacrifice family, health, even faith at the altar of this thing that they worship. And then there's those who work faithfully, who give themselves to service and love, but who feel weary. They're the people who keep showing up. They're constantly serving. They're giving of themselves, but deep down, they're sort of running out of steam. And now these various approaches to work aren't just modern issues. I think they're sort of things that happened across all civilizations. And in our passage today, Paul seems to be addressing a church where some believers are avoiding work, becoming idle and disruptive, and he's concerned about the trajectory that that's going to have. If this becomes an example that others imitate, he sees the destructive outlook for God's people. And he's wanting the community to address this issue, this idleness, this disruptiveness. He's actually calling the community to discipline these people for their actions. But we're going to look at that a little bit more specifically next week. And the discipline, the calling to attention about how people are acting isn't out of spite, but it's out of a desire to bring these people back. And in doing so, in these verses, he paints somewhat of a picture of what everyday Christian life should be like until the day that Jesus returns. Remember, that's what we're trying to move from the background of our minds to the forefront. Jesus is coming back. How do we approach the most constant thing in our life, which is work? And what we're going to see today is that waiting for Jesus well means working faithfully. It's resisting this temptation to be idle, and it's a being aware of how we might be disruptive. Now, to unpack this, there's a couple of movements. Paul sort of addresses the idle and the disruptive, and then he encourages the weary. If we have a look in verse 6, we see him begin this way. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers and sisters. Now, Paul's not coming here with a suggestion. It's sort of a military command. This is an order for the soldiers to follow. And the point is clear. Paul is coming with all the authority of God. Do not be idle. And now this idleness is about sort of disorderliness. It's about being in out of step with everyone else. It sort of carries the overtones of being irresponsible. Paul refers to them refusing to walk according to the tradition that's been passed down to them. It seems that rather than them seeing the 24 hours a day, 7 days a week that's been allocated to them as being an opportunity to invest in good things, they're just wasting that time away in idleness. Just trying to get a picture of what he's describing. Think about you're down at Circular Quay in Sydney and you've got the tourists who are there checking out the harbour. They're sort of at an idle pace because they're on holidays. That's fine. They're sort of checking things around. But you've sort of got the lunchtime worker who's got to get back for his meeting and is like purpose driven. There's sort of these two different outlooks. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a rest, having a lunch break, having a holiday. But it seems like for some people in the Thessalonian church, every day had become a holiday and that idleness was their normal. You sort of think, how could this possibly be? Well, in Thessalonica at that time, there was sort of this patronage system where there was clear hierarchies. And so there were these powerful and wealthy patrons, and they would have these clients, this sort of entourage of people around them, these hangers-on, who they provide for, and that those people were able to have security, some sort of social status, because of their connection to their patron. And it's these people who could live quite a sort of idle life. They didn't have to give account. They weren't slaves. They had no mortgages to pay. And it seems like these are the kind of people that Paul is addressing about their influence on the wider church. Their idleness was having a destabilizing effect on the body of believers. They were setting a bad influence for others to follow. And so what Paul is addressing here is actually a new outlook. While Jesus is returning, our days are given to us to be productive. Work is redeemed. There is good to be done. Paul talks himself about the right that he had to receive external support, but that when he came, he resisted that support. He raised his own support so that he could be an example of what to follow. And so, Paul is wanting to redirect this focus of those who have become idle and disruptive towards having a better view. And so we see that Paul sets himself up in verses 7 to 8 as an example to follow. And then in verse 9, his example was something that he wants them to imitate. And imitate of making the most of each day. And so Paul presents both this warning to those who might be led into an idle and sort of wasteful view of time, and sets himself up as an example of what is really worthwhile, how to really use your days. And so if we think about the sort of translation to our modern society, the patron-client thing, it doesn't really work. But perhaps there's situations in our life where we do have circumstances that lend towards being idle. Now, I'm aware I'm a parent, and this might sound a little bit tainted, but, you know, people in their sort of post-high school days, they might have parents who can cover their rent, friends who pay for their meals. They might sort of have the liberty to feel like they can sleep in as late as they want. Just sort of waiting for life to start and just sort of drifting around. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you could have someone who's been very successful in their working life and has reached the Australian dream of retiring early. And so they can also float around, one holiday to the next, grey nomad here, special lunch there, not really making the most of their time. And so this isn't sort of targeting one sort of generation or even one age group. It's addressing this temptation that idleness can be something that we drift to at any season of life. Now, just to be clear here, there are times when work is hard to find. And it's pretty obvious that the transition from childhood to adult life is a big step. And so this isn't about sort of calling people out for not getting their game together. There's also situations where you find yourself out of work, and anyone who's had to look for work when they're really trying, you know that that's the hardest work of all. You're constantly putting yourself out there, you're sending resumes, covers letters, and you're getting nothing back in return. And then there's also situations in life where, because of illness, caring responsibilities, or other circumstances, you're actually unable to be very productive at all. These situations is not what Paul is addressing at all. The problem in Thessalonica is not an inability to work, it's an unwillingness. And so being irresponsible and idle, Paul is saying it leaves you missing this great gift of the dignity of doing good work. It strips you of the joy of contributing and providing for others, where you can see the fruits of your labour. And so Paul's words for any of us who are tempted to avoid the responsibility of work is quite strong in verse 10. And parents, do not use this out of context. The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat. They're strong words, but they were necessary for the circumstance because Paul was aware of the impact that it was having on the solidarity of the community. There was a corrosion of trust. There was, rather than being a oneness in spirit, as members of one body under the one head, Jesus, there will start to be levels. And so this isn't something that has just come up out of the blue. You know, this is 2 Thessalonians. This is Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians. In 1 Thessalonians 5, he also addresses those who were idle and disruptive. Paul's revisiting an area that has been a constant issue for this church. And so whilst being idle, we see that they're not completely just passive, because Paul says they are actually doing something which is unhelpful. They are being busy bodies. It seems that these people who don't have productive things to do are getting caught up in periphery things. Think of the stereotypical sort of parents' gossip group or the neighbourhood nuisance who's not really contributing anything but just sort of disrupting everything, wasting people's times and knocking people off the main game. And so Paul here is calling out this behaviour. It's a command for them to adjust their ways. He's expecting that change is going to occur, and he's actually going to unfold a process of discipline to make sure that it happens. And so we sort of just can't sort of laugh off this idleness and disruptiveness as just being, you know, just kids being kids, or, you know, oh, that's just that person's outlook. No. Paul is leaving no room for liberty of opinion here. If they're not willing to work, they're not shouldn't be willing to eat. And so he's urging them, on the other hand, to settle down and earn the food that they eat. Now, this sort of settle down command, it's sort of this invitation to like the quiet life. The image that seems to be most strongly connected with is sort of like the life of a scholar. Now, if we think of a scholar, someone who studies a particular area, it's done in a background situation over a long time for them to gather together all the information that's out there, to collate it, to synthesize it, and then to present something finally. It's about diligent work that isn't for the applause of everyone day in, day out, but it's with a focus on knowing that there is good work to be done and that there's going to be a return on it eventually. It's a bit like the difference between, you know, if you need to just do some superficial changes, if you're going to sell your house, you just do some paint up to cover the cracks or whatever, and actually restoring a house that's broken so that it lasts. Paul is saying, don't just do the superficial cover up here. No. Invest yourself, settle down into work that is good and lasting. And so this work is work that they then need to be encouraged in. Because once you've sort of got an outlook for what work is, then the temptation is to either not make too much of it, like idolizing it, or to work out what happens when you feel weary. And so, verse 13, as for you, brothers and sisters, never tire of doing what is right. And so here, this sort of address to the rest of the congregation who perhaps are involved in good work, and it's encouragement for them to keep going even when it's hard, to stay firm when they're tempted just to give up. And so if we think about these two other aspects of how we might be leading ourselves towards work, idolizing and being weary of it, if we think about how idolizing work might often look, say someone in their 30s, you're sort of climbing the ladder in your industry, you're willing to work late and hard, you'll sort of answer emails whenever they come, you're perhaps constantly feeling the pressure to perform, but you sort of tell yourself this narrative that's only temporary. I'm just going to get over this little hurdle and then we'll be able to just cruise. But that little hurdle never comes, does it? Because there's always like more to be done. And then what's sort of revealed in this outlook is that actually work for you is more than just doing good. It's something that your identity is like wrapped up in, that you can't just put a boundary on. And so as opposed to those who are idle, for those who make work their idol, it's the very opposite. It's their ultimate. And there's this illusion that work can provide your identity. And so perhaps if you fear of one day sort of being forgotten, you think, oh no, I need to have done something that lasts. Or if you're sort of feeling unstable financially, you're like, no, this is the means for me to be secure. Or if you're feeling a little bit aimless, you can have reassurance, no, I'm doing something worthwhile here. All of these little counterpoints just sort of feed perhaps an unhealthy view of work being ultimate. And the reminder is that work can never fully provide what we desire from it. And so Paul's call for those who were avoiding work is somewhat the same for those who are idolizing work. See your work in the light of what Jesus has done. Work is never going to save you from whatever you're running away from. It's a gift. It's a calling. It's an offering. Now, I wonder if you're sort of in that third group of people thinking about work where you're just feeling a bit weary, where you already perhaps see your work as worship, where you hear and read Paul saying, never tire of doing what is good, but that's okay for you, Paul, because you're some kind of superhuman apostle. And you're perhaps just feeling like, I'm not really sure where to go. Because I'm sure there's many of us who serve faithfully in our paid and unpaid roles, who are caring in ways that no one else really sees. I know there are many of us who sort of put our hand up at every request for a volunteer, but I wonder this morning whether you're tired, whether your heart is actually growing weary of doing good, where more often than not you're looking around and wondering if any of the good that you're doing is actually making any difference at all. Perhaps there's even some frustration at other people for not stepping up and taking over these things that you've been doing for so long. Paul's word to the weary but tender heart is never tire of doing what is right. He's aware that there is discouragement that can surface, that it's easy for us to lose heart, that we can lose our motivation in doing good things. Paul is there as an encouragement to say, don't give up. Do not grow weary in doing what is right. But the outlook for this nourishment is not to be found within, but it's to be looking at the one who, remember, is seated at the right hand of the Father. Because if we think about work as avoidance, work as idolatry, and work feeling weary, we look to the Lord Jesus and see that he actually embodies this in a way that can give us sustenance and encouragement. Jesus is the one who never avoided work. From his young days to the cross, he embraced doing the work of his Father. My Father is always at work, he said, and I too am working. He was aware of the needs around him, not idle. He entered into the pain and the complexity of others' lives. From labouring with his father in a carpenter's shop to walking dusty roads to heal the sick and to bring good news, he was willing to give of himself. And so Jesus is the one who didn't avoid work. And he's also the one who didn't idolise work. He was never out to sort of prove his worth. His identity and security weren't found in what he produced, but rather in whom he was. That word of affirmation from heaven when he was baptized, this is my son with whom I am well pleased. That was the source of his strength to continue to do good in its right place. And despite the labours that Jesus endured, he didn't grow weary in doing good. Even as his friends sort of misunderstood him, when the crowds left him and when the cross loomed as the good work, he didn't tire. Having loved his own who were in the world, we read that he loved them to the end. He endured through weariness. And so, friends, whether you're feeling the pull of avoiding work and just sort of being idle where it just feels so overwhelming, or whether you're sort of starting to be convicted that you're making too much of work, it's becoming your everything, or whether your heart this morning is discouraged, you are tired, cast your eyes to the work of your Saviour. In him, our work, whether it's paid or unpaid, whether it's ordinary, unseen, seen or popular, it's a response to the great and sufficient work of Christ. Our work comes after the work that he has established, which is creating a new future. There is going to be a new creation where each of us have a part, not to be idle. You know, the new creation is not just all us on lounge chairs. It's us doing good things and having the resources and capabilities to deliver them. What a great future to be a part of. And so our work now is little foretastes of that. Little foretastes of renewal, of coming up with ideas to fix problems, of using resources that are around us to do good and to enable life to flourish. So whether our work is in the classroom as a student, in an office as a worker, outside as a labourer, in the home or in the community in unpaid roles, we get to participate in what God is doing. Friends, I thought probably the most helpful way for us to sort of try and land this was to take 5 minutes to just reflect a little bit on our work situation. However you do note-taking or consolidating of thoughts, access that now. And just some categories that perhaps might be helpful for you is to maybe just take some time to think about what is really your motivation for the things that you're doing. Why are you doing the work you do? Again, paid and unpaid work, public and private. Why are you really doing it? See, perhaps that there's something that's really driving you. Maybe there's a fear that if you aren't doing this, then everything's going to fall apart. Perhaps you're doing it out of obligation. I feel like I have to do this degree. Perhaps you're doing it for approval. I feel validated when people find out what I do. What would it look like for fear, obligation, approval to be replaced with gratitude and a joy in serving? A second category might be to try and identify if work has become ultimate. What's really driving that? What are you hoping that work's going to give you? Are you wanting to be that identity, that you have that qualification, or that you've reached that job status? Is that really what's driving these decisions that you're seeing the sacrifices that the decisions are making, whether it's physically, relationally, personally, communally, in our church community? what would it look like to you for you to be free, to have to place work in a better spot, not as ultimate? And then for the weary heart, perhaps it's helpful to just write down all the good things that you're doing. Like the good in making that phone call to just check in on someone. The good in your kids having healthy meals each day. The good amongst